I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it's February 26th at 1:35 p.m. Present today, we have Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Edgecombe. Have to move to change her name to that. Okay. Representative
Ortiz.
Representative Tomaszewski and Representative Foster.
Okay.
Good afternoon. Today the committee will hear a presentation from the Department of Fish and Game on the proposed FY25 budget. And we have here in the room today the Commissioner for Department of Fish and Game, Doug Vincent Lang. And we also have Bonnie Jensen, the Administrative Services Director. Please feel free to ask questions as we go through, unless we change that policy. Mr. Lang, if you would, like to put yourself on the record and introduce yourself and your staff, and go ahead and proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Doug Vincent Lang, the Commissioner for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. With me today is our Administrative Services Director, Bonnie Jensen.
Welcome to House Finance.
Okay. Thank you. I always enjoy these opportunities to talk to you guys. It's good. Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you.
So I'm not going to go over this in great detail because I think most of you have seen it before, but these are the divisions, departments on constitutional and statutory mandates. You know, we're kind of unique in the United States in that we actually have in our Constitution, a sustained yield principle embedded into it. And I always like to point that out because other states don't have that section of their Constitution, and it really places the importance of fish and wildlife and their sustainability into our people's livelihoods moving forward.
Will you explain just for the committee what, when you see that in the Constitution, and you're applying it to building your budget or doing your daily work, how do you interpret it?
We were having that discussion just the other day. I think when I manage a fish and wildlife stock, I'm not only managing it for its sustainability over time. If you look in the Alaska statutes, under the functions of the commissioner, that's in the interest of the economy and well-being of the state. I could manage for yield, and if it doesn't have any benefit to Alaskans or if it doesn't have any benefits to our economy, I'm really only doing half my job and just providing for the populations to be present on the landscape. So to me, this really fundamentally says that I'm supposed to be managing for a yield of these animals that benefits Alaskans and our economies moving forward. And that's embedded into all of our wildlife surveys. It's embedded into all of our fishery surveys. It's embedded into our management programs, both research and how we work with the Board of Fisheries and Board of Game to ensure that the animals that we're tasked with managing and the fish we're tasked with managing actually have a use that benefits people. And unlike most other states, we actually have any individual in our state can actually put a proposal to the Board of Fish or Board of Game to change how they would like to see the management of those resources. And as long as it doesn't affect their long-term sustainability, the board gets to decide how they would like those resources allocated out to individual users. So we have a sustained yield clause in our Constitution that tells me to manage for sustainability, and the functions of the commissioner is that's in the interest and best interest of the economy and well-being of the people. And then through the board process, they get to decide how it's allocated.
So I'm going to go ahead and just ask a couple more questions, but when it comes, this is mostly on fish, but all on fish, but so when you, obviously fishermen are having a down, I mean, the price is down, and that would be a normal economic thing where you would say, okay, we're just going to produce more to make up for it, which is obviously does not go along with our sustainable yield if you're just going to pump it up and, you know, overfish. But when you're looking at your kind of policy going forward, how do you balance your market, the product, the amount of product, and then actual sustainability over time?
So, Madam Chair, what we do is we manage for a maximum sustained yield level. So we are often closing fisheries well before the time that it's necessary to close them to ensure for their viability. viability is a whole different level, but we're trying to maximize yield off these stocks. And you know, when we're not hitting within our escapement range for those yields, we close fisheries and we restrict them. We close subsistence last because that's the highest priority under our state constitution to provide for. But we will forego short-term yield for long-term opportunity over the long term for that stock to provide that over time. So, and when you look at fisheries across the state, Chinook salmon are depressed, kind of, they have a lower level of productivity across our state. That doesn't mean that they're suffering, their viability is at risk. And we see an ESA petition right now from the Wild Fish Conservancy and North Gulf of Alaska stocks. Those stocks are far from even late run Kenai River Chinook, which we have an action plan we're trying to rebuild right now, as well as Northern Cook Inlet stocks. There's no question that those stocks remain viable. It's just that they're not providing the historic levels of yield, so we're trying to rebuild and get to that point.
Right. I just want to give an overview for the committee that hadn't been here before.
Okay, next slide.
And you probably already hit a number of points there.
This is good dialogue. This is what's needed. So we have three core services in the department: management, stock assessment and research, and customer service and public. Management is basically how we manage the stocks under the Board of Fish and Board of Game guidelines. Our stock assessment and research program really provide the information that we can provide the board and ourselves in making those management decisions moving forward. And then we have customer service and public involvement. So we try to teach people how to use and enjoy fish and wildlife across our state. We have the whole board regulatory process that's embedded in that section. But we do a lot of time to tell people how to get out and hunt and fish, just passing on that hunting heritage. Next slide. The leadership of the department is, I'm the commissioner. I have two deputy commissioners. Rachel Baker is one of them. She's the, I call her kind of like the Secretary of State. She does the interjurisdictional fisheries beyond 3 miles out in the ocean, all the council, all the treaty-related events. Ben Mulligan is the other deputy. He kind of deals with the Federal Subsistence Board program and kind of the internal dynamics, Board of Fish and Board of Game regulations. Bonnie Jensen here is our Administrative Services Director. Joe Feichel is our Legislative Liaison. He's in the back of the room here. And I have Rick Green as a Special Assistant. The Director of Commercial Fisheries is Sam Raybung. Director of Sport Fisheries is Israel Payton. Ryan Scott is our Director of Wildlife Conservation. And then we have two people that oversee the Board of Fish process, which is Christy Tibbles is the Executive Director of the Board of Game and Art Nelson is the Executive Director of the Board of Fisheries. Then we have two other sections that used to be divisions in our department. One is the Habitat section. They deal with most of the Title 16 permitting in the department, as well as coordination of department comments on major development activities. Then our Subsistence Research section, which is founded in statute, which is basically helping the board make informed decisions on the subsistence priority.
Well, I do appreciate having you before us and having you recognizing a lot of the people there, not without having a tremendous amount of turnover. Some departments, it's hard, you know, you kind of need a program to keep up with things. And most of the people I see on the slide there are people that work for you or with you in some capacity in the last several years. So I do appreciate that.
Pretty proud of that staff I put together.
Yeah, that's pretty good. All right, we have Representative Cronk and Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Do we have a division of subsistence?
Do we have what?
A division of subsistence.
We have a section of subsistence right now. At the 5 years ago when the governor first took office, we gave up the division directors for the Division of Subsistence and Division of Habitat. And the reason I gave those up was I was facing a budget cut of $200,000 in each one of those divisions at the time. Both division directors were absent. They were relatively small groups of people. So I rather than hire a director and take $200,000 of cuts in those sections, in those groups, I decided to not hire the director.
So are we saying that subsistence isn't as important as other things? Because I do believe that we need a person that is right on top of subsistence. Because, again, I'll reiterate, the most important fish or chunk of moose meat's in the freezer.
No, we're not saying that, because clearly the state statutes say that subsistence is a priority. And in some respects, it's been elevated because now I lead that section rather than just the director. So I have the responsibility, and you'll hear it when I give presentations, that I'm giving the subsistence sections right now. So,
follow up? Nope, that's it. Okay, thank you. Representative Galvin.
Rep. Kronk asked the very same question and the very same comments that I would have had. I have heard from constituents concerned about there not being a person in those particular sections, and that their concerns because they have a deep connection to the subsistence portion of fish and game. And so you heard it now a couple times. That's all I have.
Thank you.
Yeah, we don't disagree with you. Subsistence remains our priority. It's in state statutes. It's embedded into our constitution. So we continue to provide that priority. It's whether or not you have a director or whether you have the commissioner leading that effort is debatable amongst yourselves. But I want to leave no doubt that that remains the priority for the department.
All right. And then we're going to take a comment question from Representative Hand, and then we'll move along.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Continuing to beat the dead horse, finding the dead king salmon. How many people work in the subsistence section and the habitat section?
Oh, I think the subsistence, they're both in the 20s to the low 30s. Am I correct?
Yeah.
All right.
Compared to our other divisions, which have hundreds of people in it.
Okay, we're gonna take another comment question from Representative Ortiz, because he barely asked a question, so we make sure to give you an opportunity.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the chair, and thank you, Commissioner. As you know, the work that you do is particularly important to my particular district on fishing overall and subsistence in all the different ways. It's an important topic for my district. Final question on the subsistence area, though, because I do hear some concern about that from my constituents. When you said 20 to 30 people, do you know how many more or less that is from when you took the position? Granted, you had to cut budgets and things like that, but how many people now do we have dedicated to subsistence issues in comparison to 5 years ago?
Through the chair, so it's about the same. I don't think it's anything has probably grown. I can get you those numbers specifically, but remember, subsistence is defined under state statutes as a research unit. It is not a management unit. The management of subsistence is done by other divisions, Wildlife Division or the Commercial Fisheries or Sport Fish Division, depending on where it occurs in the state. So it's not a management division per se, it's a research division. We've been trying to increase, even though the UGF has gone down, the amount of surveys that group does to inform the ANS, amounts necessary for subsistence, and whether or not we're meeting those subsistence needs through community surveys. And I think you'll see in our budget request this year, we have a NOAM survey that's being put into the request for UGF this year. We've been trying to fund most of those new activities and research activities through federal grants and a variety of other things. So I think the budget has largely remained relatively stable, if not grown over time, because we've also found the avenue to basically put some wildlife conservation funding into it to do some of the waterfowl surveys for that we used to do under UGF that got cut that we now can fund with Pittman, Wallet Bro, not Wallet. What is it? DJ, not DJ.
It's
PR funds. Yeah, using PR funds. So.
Pittman Roberts.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. We'll go ahead and move along until we get to the end of page 8, and then we'll take a break and ask.
So the department's approach to managing fish and wildlife resources continued to provide a substantial return on investment to the state and local economies. We manage fish and wildlife resources in a way that produces more jobs and economic value than any other sector of the economy. Tens of thousands of jobs and hundreds of small businesses rely on activities and opportunities associated with Alaska's fish and wildlife resources. These resources provide the most valuable commercial fishing industry in the nation, are a cornerstone of our state's booming tourism industry, provide world-class hunting, sport fishing, and wildlife viewing opportunities to support an unequaled subsistence culture and economy. Harvest opportunities are critical in feeding families and preserving traditional and cultural practices vital to many Alaskans. There are no reductions in services anticipated as a result of the proposed budget. It includes new funding for fisheries and wildlife resource projects. All budgetary changes will be highlighted in later slides, but I wanted to highlight on this slide some of the new requests included in the governor's proposed budget that have focus on statehood defense, marine science and genetics, restoration of commercial fisheries, and wildlife surveys and management. I think you've all seen this slide. I've presented it a couple times in the past, but it's in your portfolio. But What I challenged my staff with when I came in is, let's make sure we're returning on the investment. It doesn't do any good if you're just spending all the money you have and you're not returning on an investment. We actually return significantly on the investment you make in the department in terms of the state economy and to the well-being of the people. Next slide. Switch over. Our budget is organized into several components. One is the sport fisheries component, which has a single component which deals with the Division of Sport Fisheries budget. Wildlife conservation has two pieces into it. One is a wildlife conservation budget, which has most of the research and management activities. The other piece is hunter education and public shooting ranges. It's kind of different than the management of wildlife. The statewide sports services, which is our admin group, has the commissioner's office into it, administrative services, the Board of Fisheries and Game, advisory committees, the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council, and state facilities maintenance. There are two hatchery components in our budget. One is the Anchorage and Fairbanks hatcheries, and the other one is the Southeast hatcheries. Those are split apart. They used to be just a hatcheries component under Sportfish, but they were split out about a couple of years ago. We have a habitat budget unit and a subsistence research and monitoring unit, as I explained earlier. And then commercial fisheries is basically based into regional components, which include the Southeast, Central, Arctic, AYK region, Westward region, which includes most of the crab fisheries in Bristol Bay, as well as a statewide regional fisheries management and research program. And finally, the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission is included in that component, but we won't be discussing that today, or the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustees, because they're kind of associated with us, but not really part of us. So in terms of, where are we, slide 9? This is a comparison slide showing overall funding of the governor's FY25 proposed budget to prior years. The FY25 amended budget request is about $250 million compared to $200 million in FY23 actuals. The FY25 governor amend budget consists of approximately $68 million in UGF, $13 million in designated general fund, $77 million in other, which is primarily fish and game fund, and the largest source of the funding for the department is federal dollars at $90 million. The FY25 budget has a total increase of 2% from the FY24 management plan, with an increase of 4.4% in the UGF. Overall, the governor's FY25 budget demonstrates the value that he places on Alaska's fish and wildlife resources and the worth of adding additional funding to address the unique challenges in fisheries and wildlife management across our state.
Representative Kronk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are we going to wait for questions at the end?
We're going to take them at the end of page 9. So whenever he's finished with his slides, so yeah, pretty soon here. All done. Okay.
So let's go back to like Pittman Robertson Fund. So who decides on those projects? Is that area bio? Is it a group effort? Any input from other groups of what's important?
So we're kind of a bottom-up driven process. So usually there's regional meetings that make recommendations to the Division of Wildlife leadership team, and they then make recommendations to me, and I'm the final decision maker on how those monies are spent.
Follow up. Okay, so I have a burning question that last week we talked about this, but it blew up over the weekend. People want to know what kind of agreement we made with the Yukon on the Yukon River fish, because they feel that there was zero public knowledge, and I don't know if anything's been finalized or but I really got blown up this weekend, and because of rumors are out there.
So that's an interesting discussion, because there's a treaty involved in Yukon River fisheries with the Yukon government. There's a lead agency, which is Fish and Game, that is designated as a designated entity for the United States government in those negotiations, and in Canada that lead agency is the Division of Fisheries and Oceans. Last summer, when we were touring Yukon fisheries, Department of Fisheries and Ocean approached us and said, we would like to have more information on what the U.S. is going to do to help Canada rebuild its Canadian origin stocks. And that's important because Canadian origin stocks migrate through the main stem Yukon River on their way, once they enter the river, all the way up river before they head to Canada. Canada's Chinook salmon stocks are severely depressed. They're to a point where they could be listed under Canada's Species at Risk Act, which is similar to the Endangered Species Act of the United States. They were asking for some assurances from the department as to what we're going to do to help rebuild those stocks so that they're not forced to list them, and then which would probably cause a federal listing on the U.S. side of the border, which comes with critical habitat designations and a variety of other things. We didn't feel that a listing and designation of critical habitat was going to help the Yukon in the long run, so we entered into discussions with DFO as to what they needed in terms of some kind of certainty to, that they could use to fight off their CERO listing in their waters. And in essence, what we did is we entered into an agreement as to what we would pass as fish into Canada to try to help them rebuild their stocks, but at the same time, allow U.S. stocks that are meeting their escapement goals to be fished on. So we agreed over the next 7 years to potent, well, we're still discussing with them, but we fundamentally agreed that we would have a pause on commercial sport and personal use fishing until we reach that border passage objective. And then they could use that assurance in terms of their assessment of the CERO petition that they have. And they felt that that would be sufficient for them to not list them in Canada. We did not agree to not fishing on U.S. stocks that are meeting their escapement goals. The critical issue is are we going to allow, as our chum stocks rebuild in that river, chum salmon opportunity using gillnets in the main stem Yukon River? As long as I'm commissioner, we're not going to do that because we are not going to put at risk Chinook salmon stocks heading into Canada that are caught indiscriminately with gillnets. So we've agreed to put a pause on gillnet fishing. We're still going to harvest chum salmon, but they're going to be with the gear types that we've developed over the last 4 or 5 years, including dip nets and a variety of other gears. Those gears will continue to be allowed. And the other thing is we negotiated with this is that, unlike right now, on both sides of the border, there is a complete closure of subsistence fishing when we're not meeting our border passage goals. This agreement allows us to open up a limited, very limited cultural camps up and down the river and having use of Chinook salmon for funeral purposes and other traditional purposes, so that as we rebuild these stocks, we don't kill culture in the meantime. We both understand on both sides of the border we need to have those cultural opportunities so people can touch fish. And we've also agreed to continue our efforts at the council level to look at things like bycatch in the trawl fisheries as well as intercept fisheries in the RAM area.
Yeah. Follow up. Thank you. I appreciate that. Is a fish wheel, would that be a lot safer to use than nets in the river?
Yeah, you can right now use fish wheels in the upper river. Fish wheels don't really work that well in the lower river, is our understanding. That's why we've gone to gill nets and a variety of. We're also looking at the opportunity to have very shallow gill nets that don't touch the bottom as an opportunity to catch chum salmon. The good news is on the Yukon is we're starting to meet our summer chum objectives. We're still lagging a little. We barely made our fall chum objectives, and that was with the fishery closed. But the outlook for summer chum is to have, to again, meet our escaping goal and have subsistence opportunity on our side of the border and possibly to have a fall chum fishery again this year for subsistence on our side of the border, but not Chinook.
Thank you.
All right, and my intent was when we got through nine, if we can finish up kind of our general questions, and then we'll kind of dig into the budget, the number part. So if you have questions other than the budget, now would be the time to ask them. I mean, not too in depth on things other than the budget, please. But anyway, Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, as a follow up on Representative Cronk's question in relationship to moving down towards a moratorium agreement with Canada, understand the reasons why that would be. You did mention in passing, though, that you were going to continue to look at the bycatch issue as having an impact on those stocks. What does that mean in relationship to, in other words, I hear, again, a lot about the issue of bycatch and the impact of bycatch on those particular, not only those particular stocks, but stocks of other things that are more in my area. And so my question is, what's going to happen with bycatch?
So right now the council is looking at, we have a Chinook bycatch limit that's established by the council that floats with abundance. We're now looking at whether we're going to do the same thing now with chum salmon. That will be taken up.
The term floats of abundant?
It's basically based on what we project to be the abundance of Chinook salmon coming back in a given year to Norton Sound area, the Yukon, and the Cusco. So right now we're in the lowest level of abundance that's projected, and we have a cap, I think, at 12,000 Chinook salmon that can be harvested. And right now, the actual catch of Chinook salmon, because of voluntary measures being taken in the trawl industry, is less than 6,000. Those are sub-adults. By the time you factor everything in, it's a pretty low level of bycatch. So we're looking at whether we can do that same thing now with chum salmon. It's all through the council process. It's a little bit more complex because almost all of the Chinook salmon that are caught as bycatch are of Alaskan origin. When you get to chum salmon, about 80% of those are of Russian hatchery origin. So the issues are a little bit more complex, and we don't want to drive down Russian chum salmon bycatch only to have it increase Chinook salmon bycatch. So we're being a little cautious in how we approach this, because we certainly don't want to have the law of unintended consequences bite us, where we end up saving Russian chum as bycatch only to have Chinook salmon bycatch increase.
Thank you. Thank you.
Final question, Representative.
And then on intercept, I think it was the other questions. We're looking at those too. We instituted the major intercept fishery for AYK fish is in the Area M fishery. It was a very controversial meeting we had 2 years ago, but we successfully brought chum salmon bycatch now down from 1.2 million in the month of June 2 years ago to 500,000 the previous year. And this year we had the chum salmon bycatch down to less than 200,000. And again, the vast majority of those are not AYK origin fish. So, but we've done that, factor that out through genetic research, and we're going to start that genetic research on Chinook salmon this year.
Right. Very good. And we have a last brief question, Representative Hannon.
Still have the Yukon Kings. Once upon a time, the Canadians had a King hatchery in Whitehorse. I think it's been closed 20, 25 years. Does the ADFNG have any ability to work collaboratively with them on reopening the King hatchery in Whitehorse that would benefit the entire river drainage?
So that is a mitigation hatchery for the dam they built across the Yukon River. Remind you that Canada's got the only dam that completely blocks passage in the entire Yukon River drainage. That mitigation hatchery is not what I would call a model of mitigation hatcheries. It's certainly not how we would design a hatchery. It's still operational. Part of the problem is that the run 10 years ago at the Whitehorse Dam up the fish ladders there was 10,000. Last year they had less than 90 fish go up. So their ability to produce fish is now largely dependent upon taking fish out of the raceway and then rearing them in the hatchery. The way they do that is they basically take those fish out of the raceway, which is a combination of about 70 stocks above the dam. They rear those in the hatchery. Then they take them upriver to a single tributary and put them in the river. Well, that kind of destroys the genetic integrity of that river because it's a mixed stock being embedded into a single stock. So it's not a very good design of a hatchery. So now the discussion is, what do you do now that you have those low of numbers? Canada's interested in building another kind of a hatchery program that keeps genetic integrity alive in those stocks. And we're very interested in working with them because it's in our best interest to have genetic integrity preserved up there. But that's going to take some serious work. And there's a lot of people on the U.S. side of the border that don't want to have any kind of a hatchery restoration program. But when we're facing these numbers in Canada, it's time to take a look at that option and figure out how to do it right.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Tomaszewski.
Real quick. Thank you through the chair, Johnson. So on your return on investment, it says Alaska exports 2.2 billion pounds of seafood each year, returning over 3.7 billion of new money into the U.S. economy. Looks like about $1.68 per pound. What's the state's cut on that?
So what is fish taxes? It's we collect most of that through fish taxes that are collected off the processor sale. I think that's 6%, 3% is kept by the state, and 3% goes back to the local community. So I'd have to do the math. We can get you that math, though.
I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we were starting into the budget portion, so I just wanted to ask one question that showed that, well, it's not a lot, but the whatever slide we were on shows that the DG looks like it's down. I was just wondering if you'd just start out by telling us why that DGF has dropped.
I didn't hear the last part.
Oh, the DGF on the second line there shows it's went down between 24 and 25. I was just wondering what that number reflected.
You know?
Yeah. For the record, my name is Bonnie Jensen. I'm the Administrative Services Director. Chair Johnson, in a future slide, it'll show a fund swap in the Division of Commercial Fisheries.
Okay, where are we here?
I think we're finished with, finished with page 9.
So this slide shows a funding breakdown by line items and the difference between the FY25 governor's amended budget and the FY24 management plan. Personal services increases consist of salary, health insurance, and PERS adjustments and other related increases that will be outlined in later slides. Some of the differences are realignments to reflect budgetary needs that more accurately between FY24 and FY25. As you can see, we're like most other agencies. We have a significant amount, about 65-70% into personnel services, with the next big group being the next big group being services, mostly because of contract work we do with aircraft and a variety of other things. By breakdown, we are primarily 36% of our budget money consists of federal funds, 33% of unrestricted and designated general funds, and 31% of our budget are other funding sources, which are the largest fish and game interagency receipts and debt, statutory designated receipts. This slide summarizes the information I just presented, but in greater detail. I don't know if you want me to go through this or if you just want to kind of have it in your records. I can go through it if you want.
One moment. I will ask that question of our subcommittee chair. Would you like to go through this? I suspect you all have went through this in detail. Is that right, Representative Kroc? I think this is your subcommittee.
Madam Co-Chair, we have not got through a ton of this, so.
Probably will, but why don't you hit the high? I don't know that you need to read off the whole slide to us, but if you would hit the high points on the differences, and I represent Martez that you wanted to make.
Well, I think we're going to go through a lot of the differences in the next couple slides. That
all right, that's perfectly fine then.
So, in terms of where this money is going in the department and its budget components, our biggest division is the Division of Commercial Fisheries at $86 million. Our Division of Wildlife Conservation used to be the third largest division. It's now the second largest because of the growth of PR Pittman Robertson funds, but it's now almost $70 million. Division of Sport Fish is the third largest, and then Statewide Support Services, DAS, which is our $26 million. And as I said before, the two smaller sections now are Habitat and Subsistence.
Representative Galvin.
In terms of budgeted history of our PCNs,
Representative Galvin has a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. Through the chair, on slide 12, I see a couple of spots where we're seeing differences. It looks like one point that are showing fewer funds coming in as receipts. I assume that's because the market is so difficult right now, but I just thought I would ask to clarify.
Representative Galvin, through the chair, we'll go over it in the Division of Commercial Fisheries. There is a fund swap where the general fund program receipts were increased in prior years, and that fund is going to be depleted soon.
Thank you. Follow up, if I may.
Just go ahead. I want to make sure we make it through the presentation. Keep going.
At slide 13, I see that the subsistence section again is, I think maybe it looks like this, almost the second smallest section there next to Habitat. And again, I just sometimes they say if you want to know what people value and prioritize, then look at their budget. To me, in this space, it says to me that subsistence may not be a high priority. And so I just wanted to point that out as someone, who appreciates that this is what everyone in the public sees.
Yeah, so through the chair, I'd like to just talk a little bit about that. This is the amount of money the department is spending on subsistence research. Mm-hmm. It's not the amount of money the department is spending on subsistence management or the research of fish stocks or wildlife stocks that are dependent upon it. Mm-hmm. I would argue right now the entirety of what we're doing in terms of Mulchatna caribou is really trying to preserve subsistence opportunity in those local villages, though. So one could argue that a good chunk of what is embedded into the orange, blue, and gray bars are probably related to providing opportunity for subsistence users across our state. But by statute, that green area recommend is what we're portraying as being expended on subsistence research activities to inform board decisions.
Thank you.
This slide provides a historic look back in our budgeted positions over the past decade. The department has seen our PCN count go down until a recent increase in these last 2 years. However, at the same time, the department's budget has grown and remaining staff had to take on extra loads. Staff are at capacity and we're now asking for additional PCNs to address the workload and provide support for the ongoing work of the department. I think I came in front of you last year and I talked a little bit about where we were with PCNs, and I said we're at a point where we're breaking Office of Management and Budget, and the Governor's Office heard that and has actually added in some PCNs to help us get through this, especially as our budget potentially increasing with some of the increments that are on the table here, both in the capital budget and the operating budget. And most of the decrease that happened in FY 15, 16, and 17 were non-perm positions that were vacant. We really didn't lose any full-time positions due to layoffs or anything else.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, going back to, or the slide that's before us on 14, you're there. And then looking at the next slide, 14 reflects a time back in 2015 when we had a lot more, significantly more PCNs working in the department than they are today, though you say it is creeping back up again. And then with that, though, do you have a graph that talks about resources that we were dedicating towards fish and game management in order so that we can fulfill our constitutional obligation, maximum sustainable yield, those kinds of things? Do we have a comparison available to us that says, oh, back in 2019, we were spending so much towards this overall goal compared to how much we're spending right now to the overall goal, and keeping in mind inflation as well? Is that available to us somewhere?
So I think what you're asking for is we have a stock assessment and management breakdown of this versus administrative oversight of the program?
Not so much. I'm just trying to say, like Representative Galvin was saying, our priorities, where are they in relationship to the Finance Committee's overall priorities, what we try to reflect is important to us. Certainly for me, that we do a good job of managing our fish resources to maximum sustainable yield is really an important priority. And what I want to know is, do you have the resources to fulfill the requirements of managing to maximum sustainable yield for the good of our economy, for the good of our people, today in 2025 or in your proposed budget for fiscal year 2025? And could you do more? Could you do a better job? Could you make more opportunity out there available to our fishermen, not just commercial fishermen, but sports fishermen, subsistence? Could you do more if you had more resources? Could you do a better job of fulfilling your constitutional obligation?
So I think the governor's budget accurately reflects the right balance in terms of preserving scarce fishing UGF resources moving forward. Could we always do more? Everyone could do more. We could do more with public safety. We could do more with teachers, a variety of other things. So that's your guys' call to figure out whether more is needed. I think I'm doing a fairly good job. I think since we came in, my budget was $195 million when I became commissioner. Now it's almost $250 million. So I think the governor and I both recognize the value of added resources into our department. The PCN count is still troublesome, but we're starting to make arguments that we need more PCNs to fill those roles. I think we're doing a pretty good job in meeting the needs. Could we do more? Yeah. When we look at Wildlife Division, our PR funds are significantly up. We've been able to do more with those dollars in terms of assessing wildlife across our state. fisheries. I guess we could do a few more fishery assessments, but we pretty much have a pretty good handle on most of the fisheries across the state. We've been able to address the issues regarding the Yukon this last 3 years. A significant amount of money went into Yukon research, not all of it UGF. I'm pretty proud to say that we've been able to tackle down federal funding for a lot of that work to answer some of those questions. And when you see most of our budget, a lot of it's in capital budgets. You know, we also instituted a marine science program now to look at the questions regarding the fate of salmon when they hit the ocean. We participated in the International Year of Salmon Research Project. So, no, I think we're doing a pretty good job.
Thank you.
All right, thanks.
I think the next slide is yours.
For the record, it's Bonnie Jensen. This slide shows our position vacancy history. And it's important to remember that our department has field seasons during the year. And during those seasons, the vacancy can vary based on the type of assessments and other field work being performed. Roughly half of the workforce for the Division of Commercial Fisheries, Sport Fish, and Wildlife Conservation Divisions are permanent part-time seasonal employees. Seasonal employees peak during field season, low vacancy, and during the off-season, high vacancy. Over 70% of the vacancies for the Divisions of Commercial Fisheries and Sport Fisheries are seasonal. As we enter the field season, the divisions will start recruitment for those PCNs. You'll notice a rather large dip in the vacancy percentage between FY17 and FY19 when 91 positions were deleted. A lot of these positions were vacant, which caused our vacancy percentage to lower. As noted in previous slide, the department has determined they need to increase the number of PCNs in order to manage our resources effectively. So there has been an increase in position in recent years. In turn, we will see a slightly higher vacancy percentage because when a new PCN is added, we cannot fill it immediately. We need to create the position description and then go through the recruitment process, which also takes time. We do expect the vacancy rate to even out as new positions are filled. This slide highlights the FY25 budgetary changes for the Division of Commercial Fisheries. In the Southeast Region Fisheries Management component, they are requesting an additional $85,000 in unrestricted general funds to add an administrative assistant one. They took on 24 positions from the Division of Sport Fisheries for the Pacific Salmon Treaty projects in FY23, which saw an increase of about 17% in the total amount of payroll to process, the increased number of projects to budget for, and an increase in procurement needs.
I'm going to just add a little bit to this. We did a survey inside the department about what were some of the issues department staff were feeling about and why they were leaving their jobs. And there were two issues. One of you hear later is the lack of safety training when we put them out in the field. And the second one is administrative workload. We're having biologists that do professional work that are just taking on this inordinate amount of administrative workload in terms of buying things, just purchasing things, one card, all these different transactions. And so we're trying to address that through these hiring some additional administrative support to try to take that workload off of the biologists and put it into the administrative staff where it belongs so that when we hire a biologist, they're not spending 20% of their time doing administrative workload.
All right. Next, I'm going to talk about inflation. The Division of Commercial Fisheries has experienced increased operational costs in certain areas for food, fuel, and charters. Some level of inflation will remain embedded in the current operational cost. However, if this funding is not secured, then assessment and research projects will have to be modified in the upcoming season, which will likely lead to more conservative management of Alaska's fisheries. You'll see these throughout all the components in commercial fisheries. In Southeast Region, they're requesting a $50,000 increase in unrestricted general funds.
Yeah, I'll just add a little bit here. I squirmed a little bit when I saw the word inflation in here. But the reality is that costs are increasing. And for the first time, I think we had office management budget say, yeah, costs are increasing. So we were facing either, you know, when you look at these numbers, like I think there's 85,000 Southeast region, 100K in Central region, 75K in the AYK region, you know, we were going to lose almost $500,000 worth of projects if we didn't get inflationary cost increases. So we toyed as to whether to call it inflation or whether to say it's a preservation of these projects. We can provide you the projects that we were saved by getting these cost increases, but real projects that we depended upon to manage for our resources would go away if these inflationary costs weren't covered.
Representative Hannon.
Madam Chair, I think my question is either for you or for the subcommittee chair, but understanding from the slide that it's broad inflation, if these are adopted, they're not going to appear in the budget as line item on inflation. I assume they become embedded in projects or service contracts, or are they going to be held out as inflation as a component in the budget?
Well, I don't anticipate seeing an inflation line in the budget. I mean, I think that would be kind of unusual for a government budget generally.
Yes. So would they appear then just, let's just say in the central region fisheries management, will it just appear in the services contract, or is it, does it disappear into the budget?
I will be honest and say I don't know entirely how it will go in. I'd have to look at the titles, but I don't think it will be impossible to figure. It would be fairly easy to figure that out. I mean, it will go into the budget in the various lines when we introduce the CS, probably, and assuming it makes it through the subcommittee and doesn't get changed. But when we put it in, then it'll be. We can go over that if you wish, where it goes into it at. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the chair. This is kind of what I did a poor job of communicating it the last time about my could you do more question. Really, what I was asking about was this idea of we all know that we're dealing with added costs, and how is that impacting your department in relationship to you? The admin services director was mentioning very quickly about foregone opportunity if we don't get these resources. In other words, that's what I was hitting at. I was trying to hit at, are we giving up something by not better funding fish and game? Is there an opportunity cost that we're looking at, potentially looking at, for our commercial fishermen and for other fishing groups as well, if we don't do whether you call it dealing with inflation or a better job of funding the department? That's all I was trying to get at.
Yeah, so I've asked all my division, I asked my commercial fisheries division director, I said, so what happens if we don't get these inflationary
right.
costs? And we have a list of projects that will go away. Yeah,
yeah.
The answer to that
yeah.
is yes. We will not do specific projects like the king crab in Southeast Alaska if we don't get this kind of money.
And potentially that will have, I'm sorry, potentially that will have an impact on the commercial fishermen who look to make a livelihood off those resources. Okay, that's all. Thank you very much.
Well, since I've got the gavel now here, at least temporarily,
okay.
I did want to just make the general observation that it's quite interesting. At the committee level here, we see the different agencies and how inflation, whatever inflation means, because once upon a time got a degree in finance many years ago, and I remember talking about academically what inflation means, but in Alaska it's cost of living increases, and inflation in the Department of Corrections is one thing, inflation in the Department of Education, in DOT it's concrete and fuel and things like that. In your department, when I look at the bottom line there, it might be air taxi rates too, right? You know, the cost
air
of flying and
rates,
things like that.
Charter rates.
That
fuel
really
rates.
Don't mirror what you would normally associate with the technical definition of inflation. And I, you know, those of us that live out in the bush know that inflation is it's non-existent. It could be just 15% a year when it's 2.3% nationally. But the other point, Commissioner, I wanted to bring up is that you know, just a couple of slides ago, that's slide 14, it's interesting. You and I have had this conversation that over time, as the tier one, tier two employees sort of vacate the scene, you're bringing on employees that are maybe don't cost as much as they did before, at the expense of senior management people, senior employees leaving the scene. But even, you know, even with that in mind, it's still getting more expensive for you to do your business, right? And I just thought I would point out that this discussion about I don't want to call it brain drain because that's unfair. You probably have a lot of great employees who are younger and are very capable, but there's a changing of the guard in your agency, just as there is in state troopers leaving the scene and teachers and people in other agencies as well.
Yeah, if I could just real quick, just, you know, I think we have a lot of field offices and a lot of field camps. Field activities are expensive. You know, when most departments talk about inflationary costs, it's mostly on salary increases, right, other things. We also have significant increases associated with just doing our field work. Cost of gas is higher. The cost of air charter is higher. The cost of boat charter is higher. It just across the board, it just increases.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Well, I would suggest that this could be a good opportunity for the subcommittee to take a look at the additional costs and inflation. So we'll work with the subcommittee chair on those various things.
All right. Continuing with the Southeast Region Fisheries Management component, we are requesting an increase of $200,000 in statutory designated program receipts for the Pacific Salmon Commission Northern Fund agreements. And then in the Central Region Fisheries Management component, they're asking for $100,000 in UGF for inflation. And in the Arctic Yukon and Kuskokwim Region Fisheries Management components, we are requesting a $90,000 UGF increase to reclass one accounting technician and add another accounting technician to support that area. Currently, the headquarters accounting team is assisting AYK with their accounting needs because the workload is not manageable at their current staffing levels. The accounting tech 3 reclass is needed to perform higher level duties like approving journal entries and auditing reimbursable projects to ensure we are utilizing those at their full capacity. Additionally, at this level, the position will be able to help the division with all of their accounting needs during fiscal year end. And in turn, they will need an accounting tech 1 to take over the lower level duties. And AYK is requesting a $75,000 increase in general fund for inflation. I'm moving on to Western Region. They're asking for a $100,000 statutory designated program receipt increase for a Northern or North Pacific Research Board Red King Crab projects. And they are asking for a $75,000 UGF increase for inflation. The last component in commercial fisheries is the statewide fisheries management component. The two labs are requesting together a $85,000 UGF increase. $35,000 of it will go to the pathology lab, and $50,000 will go to the mark, tag, and age lab. This is to cover longstanding employees because there is no vacancies, and basically inflationary costs for supplies and travel. And the statewide component is also asking for a $50,000 UGF increase for inflation. Moving on, we're asking to add $100,000 of statutory designated program receipts. This is for a kelp project in the genetics lab. And this is what you were asking for earlier, Chair Johnson, the change in general fund program receipts. It's a fund swap. So we're asking to decrease GFPR by $1.5 million and do an increase of general fund of just over $783,000 and an increase in CFEC receipts to just over $716,000.
So you did a draw a couple of years ago on crew member licenses, and that's unsustainable over time. And if we don't fix that, we're going to run that pond down nothing and then take a cut because of it. So.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Could you explain to me, a draw on the crew member license fund, why we draw on it and why isn't it?
The amount of draw has been unsustainable to the amount of money being collected. So you in a class as a replacement for UGF, the legislature chose and governor's office chose to replace, take a greater draw out of it than was sustainable over time. Mm-hmm. And I think last year we warned everybody saying that that's not sustainable. And now we're coming back to you saying that truly is not sustainable. So if we want to move forward, we're going to have other funding sources other than that license funding source.
So could I follow up in a slightly different way?
Yes, go ahead.
Are we in charge of what those crew member licenses sell for in value? And if the numbers are predictable of how many we're going to sell, could we adjust the price we're charging for crew member licenses?
It is set by statute. It is completely under your authority. It's not. I do not set that.
Set by statute.
Remind me if that was a bill that we passed. Was there a bill involved?
We've been discussing a bill on crew member licenses for a long time, and it never gets traction because, especially in the current market condition, crew members are probably not buying the number of licenses that we probably need for crew members in the commercial fishery right now. So,
Madam Co-Chair, is somewhat resident historian here. The last actual tax bill we passed was in 2016. It was a bill to not crew members' license was involved. Representative Tallarico's bill and House Bill 137, I think it was. And but that was the last bill that we passed that impacted your department primarily, if I remember right. Then the sort of the last tax increase that we've had in the legislature.
Yeah, the general fish tax or commercial crew member license tax have not increased under my leadership.
Yeah. Now, so.
I remember some discussion. All right. Thank you.
All right. Moving on to the Division of Sport Fisheries, they are requesting an increase of $1.1 million in Fish and Game Fund receipt authority and a decrease in CIP receipts to replace unavailable capital improvement projects to support existing programs. This fund swap is predominantly needed to cover increased core services costs and overall inflationary costs. Additionally, the level of federal funding is projected to decrease by $1 million between FY24 and FY25. So for the Anchorage and Fairbanks hatcheries, we are requesting an increase of $350,000 in unrestricted general fund to cover continued high utility costs at both the Ruth Burnett and William Jack hatcheries to remedy the ongoing shortfall, giving multi-year rate increases anticipated in Anchorage that were announced this summer.
We have a question, Rep. Stapp.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Through the chair to our fish folks. So just on the, it says here on utilization as well as rates. So I'm very well aware of the 75.3% increase because I did get my GVA bill in the mail while I was down here. Is the hatchery in Fairbanks, are you guys utilizing more power, or is that just a straight up fuel surcharge and power increase on the property?
So we had cut back some of the production out of the Fairbanks hatchery several years ago, and I gave instructions to the Fairbanks hatchery to get up to full capacity. So I can imagine that both usage and rates have double dipped into that Fairbanks hatchery.
Okay, thank you.
right. In the Division of Wildlife Conservation, we are requesting a $300,000 increase in IA receipts to add two natural resource specialists for statehood defense in federal subsistence board arena to address an increased workload related to the review of federal subsistence board proposals and statehood defense activity. Over the last 4 years, we have seen a marked increase in federal encroachment of the state's rights to manage its fish and wildlife resources through the Federal Subsistence Board. To adequately address the increased workload to analyze these proposals and properly support the department and the state of Alaska in opposing federal overreach, these two positions would be dedicated 100% to this work.
So I see you. We do have a couple other. We have another hand in front of you, Representative Hannon, Representative Josephson, and then I have a question. All done.
Thank you. Through the chair. So my question, I have a couple questions about the statehood defense. One, I don't know what IA receipts are, and then are these new positions, and I'm looking for a description of what these positions are. These wildlife biologists, or are they lawyers?
So through the chair. We have a lot of interaction with the Federal Subsistence Board right now on wildlife management issues. We don't question their authority to manage wildlife on wildlife lands, but how those wildlife populations that cross between federal and state lands are managed is critical towards providing for sustained yield over time. These are two positions that just will interact with the Federal Subsistence Board in how their regulatory process works so that we can inform them on the wildlife data that we have, the fisheries data that we have, and how they can incorporate that into their decision making. These are not lawyers. That's a different statehood defense piece of it. But this is to ensure that as we go through that dual management regulatory structure, that we're both cognizant of what's happening, and to the extent possible, we can cooperate to ensure for sustained yield of those stocks.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, IA is interagency receipts, and they're just going to come from the Department of Law.
That was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so. But these are biologist positions. These are not lawyers.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, and we have Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, good afternoon, Commissioner.
Yeah.
Sorry I was late this afternoon. Can you give me an example of something the Federal Subsistence Board asserts that the state challenges? I know, and just so we're clear, I know, for example, about refuge rulemaking and what the federal government asserts through the Department of the Interior, but what is the Subsistence Board saying that we object to?
Well, let's use an example. In Southeast Alaska, there was a Federal Subsistence Board proposal that would have restricted deer hunting on federal lands to anybody but a federally qualified user. So the question comes down to, is that necessary given the deer population numbers that we're having? So we would have, these people would work with our staff to provide the Federal Subsistence Board and the Federal Subsistence staff the information to say, this is the level of deer populations that we have. Here's the level of use that we're seeing currently in those populations. Is it necessary to restrict federal lands to only federally qualified users and take that opportunity away from people that live in Sitka, Juneau, and Ketchikan? So it's a biological discussion as to whether or not we can interject with them. We did not in this case feel that it was necessary to restrict federal lands to only federally qualified users. We felt there was a harvestable surplus to meet the needs for all subsistence users in the state, irrespective of whether they were just limited to federally qualified users.
So that's it. It is so refreshing to get a really concrete answer. I thank you for it. I mean that. But I assume that the Subsistence Board had its own data and it felt otherwise about the deer population. Is that where the tension arose?
Interestingly enough, in almost all the cases, the state is the primary manager of the resource, yet it has almost all the data that's coming to the table. So instead of having my biologists who are out there doing most of the research, we would hire these two staff members to coordinate that and work with our staff so our staff isn't just pulled away from their regular management and research duties, and they can have this group of people interact with the Federal Subsistence Board. It's not going away. It seems to be increasing. Another one came down to the Northwest Alaska Arctic herd, where we still have, even though it's declined from 500,000, we still have 180,000 caribou. You know, is it necessary when you have a daily limit of 5 caribou to restrict that herd to only federally qualified users and not have people that have historically lived in that area, for instance, the governor's wife, to go up and participate in that as a subsistence user from the state level? So we're trying to balance that all subsistence user opportunity versus the federally qualified and when it's necessary to make that limitation.
Thank you.
All right, Representative Edson.
Yeah, Commissioner, what does statehood defense mean?
So to me, that means that I'm defending the rights of Alaskan subsistence users to participate when there's a surplus, harvestable surplus available to them. So if the federal subsistence program unnecessarily restricts that uses, I'm not defending our state subsistence priority.
I only ask because this issue came up at AFN. There's pending lawsuit, as you well aware, if you're a sort of a principal and all that. And as far as I know, there's no definition in regulation or in statute for defense, statehood defense. It is, if inflation is a term of art, statehood defense even rises above that in terms of being just a catch-all term that's right out there. Department of Defense has their definition of statehood defense. Department of Fish and Game has its version of statehood defense. And I raise that because it's become a bit of a trigger term these days, and unfortunately there is antagonism between many elements of the Native community and the administration over the Katie John decision and some other things again that you have been involved in terms of apprising us of. Thinking back, I guess to a phone call or whatever it was this past fall that we had with you on this topic. But my eyebrows do raise when I've seen statehood defense and a couple of biologists who are not lawyers. Mm-hmm. This is mostly a legal effort supported, I guess, by biologists. I wanted to hear your version of it because it's something that the administration asked for $2 million in statehood defense, right? Those are interagency receipts with the Department of Law. I guess some of that $2 million goes to Fish and Game. As a policymaker, it's beneficial to kind of know how this money works its way from one agency to another agency and serves a term that might be broader than just a couple of biologists.
Well, I think it's a continuum. I think there are issues that statehood defense means to me that if the state was granted its navigable waterways at statehood, I think the state has a defense of that granting of navigable waterways. I think that's a legal issue more than a biological issue. But when I was talking to Representative Hannah, I was trying to say from a biological perspective, statehood defense means that we're providing that yield to Alaskans under our state subsistence law. And to the extent that that's being unnecessarily restricted, we're defending the rights of state subsistence users over the necessity of closing for a subset of those.
I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Okay, moving on.
May I just go back on, I'm sorry, one point on the statehood defense. I mean, there has to be, part of that's got to be gathering data and making sure that we're clear. I mean, it's more than just Department of Law, that they have all the information and the statistics they need to have to make their case, I guess. Wouldn't you say, I mean, it's not 100% just Department of Law, I wouldn't think.
No, clearly when we're arguing navigability, there's pieces of DNR that need to go out in the field and assess whether or not a river is actually navigable or not. So there's data that goes into their defense of those navigable waterways. There's questions in the Kuskokwim River, for instance. Again, that's another example where the Federal Subsistence Board has exerted authority over that navigable waterway, which is clearly navigable. But in the meantime, do we want to make sure that state people that have grown up in Bethel, that are state-qualified subsistence users, are not unnecessarily precluded from having opportunity if there's enough fish to feed both people that have been displaced into Anchorage for education, health, or social reasons can still go out and participate. So we try to work with the Federal Subsistence Board saying you don't need to, in this case, because the harvestable surplus numbers restrict that fishery to only federally qualified users at this time. There's surplus fish to meet the needs of other Alaskans that have traditionally participated in that fishery.
Madam Chair. And I wasn't trying to be contentious. Might have come off that way, but we do have a bill that's making its way. I think it's Senate Bill 92 on the Resources Committee that talks about submerged lands and expanding the definition. I think that's going to find sort of opposing forces when the thing gets to the House floor, coming to each other. And it ties into this issue, right, to some degree. And just a larger picture that's involved in some of these appropriation items that we have to make a decision on.
And the reality is, as we go through those complex issues like the Kuskokwim River, we recognize right now the federal support is there, so we need to address that because we have responsibility to meet escapement above the refuge where the federal land management is, and we have the primary responsibility to provide for subsistence needs above the refuge. So if we're not working with them to pass fish upriver to get to escapement and to get those upriver users, we're failing in defending their rights upriver. So.
The Division of Wildlife Conservation is also asking for just over $1.3 million of unrestricted general funds to fully substantiate the Threatened and Endangered Species Program under the State Wildlife Grant Program, SWIG, and other marine mammal programs. These programs cannot use federal PR funds or Fish and Game Fund and have largely functioned on in-kind and external match. A consistent match funding source will increase levels of service and will allow both the SWIG and the Marine Mammals Program to commit to and potentially expand existing projects.
And the number of ESA petitions we're getting is not going down, folks. It's only increasing. We have petitions now on brown bats. We have northern bog lemming. We have petitions on butterflies and bees. And yeah. Did you get the last one?
Oh, yeah. So they're also asking for just over $5 million in Fish and Game Fund authority. This is to match Pittman's and Robertson matching funds. They require a 1-to-3 match requirement, so it's and it's also to support agency operations. In the fiscal year 2022, the Pittman-Robertson PR federal apportionment increased by $16 million over the prior year, and in federal fiscal year 2023, PR increased an additional $6 million over a FY22 apportionment.
So the good news here is that we have more PR funds. We were reverting them several years ago. We're not reverting any PR funds with that one-time increment we got in 2024. Fortunately, we have Fish and Game Fund money that we can match that, so we don't have to revert in the past. We asked for these as increments because we're not convinced PR funds are going to continuously increase, but they don't seem to be decreasing. So we may at some point in time ask for this as a base if the Fish and Game Fund can do it. But right now, if we don't get this $5 million in Fish and Game Fund authority, I can't guarantee that we won't revert PR funds.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Can the Pittman-Roberts funds be used for invasive species work in wildlife and or fisheries?
On wildlife, they can. Not so clear on fisheries. It would have to. These are hunter dollars, PR funds, shooting ranges and hunting. So it's a little bit less likely that I could use them for green crab.
One follow-up?
Yes, go ahead.
I see it as a bullet on your very last slide, invasive species, but I continually hear that we're sort of not putting enough time, attention, money, research into invasive species and that we need to be doing more. Is it appearing anywhere in your budgeted ways that I'm just not seeing it? To make sure we're prepared as we see some habitat change and, you know, moose hunt on the Yukon now up to 3 daily bag limit. That's not an invasive species, but coming down behind it is going to be something.
Fortunately, we're being able to plug a lot of those holes with federal funds that are coming in to deal with like invasive green crab down in Metlakatla, a variety of other things. And we're working with other individuals to tackle those that have money. Could we do more? Yeah, I think we had a bill last year that was the hatchery surcharge bill that got tacked on an additional surcharge for invasive species, but that did not get reintroduced this year. So I think sometime in the future we may come back with some kind of a unique idea for funding invasive species work, but it's not in this year's budget. But it's not because we're not doing anything about invasive species. We're just finding unique ways of tackling those issues.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a question from Representative Kronk, and then we're going to finish up the slides show and then take the last. So save your questions for the end, except for Representative Kronk.
Thank you, Madam Coach. So Pittman Robinson's Fund. So if we have all these different organizations of, you know, youth shooting and stuff, can these funds be used to help purchase a range or equipment for a range?
Yes, it can be used for shooting ranges. And what we've done is we've entered into these agreements where we will work with anybody to build a shooting range as long as we don't operate it, because there's at the end of the shooting range, we don't want to get in the thing where new money coming in the department is just going to pay the increased operational costs of it. So we are more than willing to work with anybody to operate a shooting range.
Follow up. Thank you, Matt. So would that just be an outdoor shooting range or indoor shooting range?
It could be indoor, outdoor. The only thing is we're using PR funds. It can't be a private shooting range. It has to be open to the public. So because it's public dollars that are going into it, we can't just give a private shooting company outrange money and that they're restricting access to.
Thank you.
All right, at that point, I'm going to ask you to go ahead and carry on until you get to the end, and if there's questions, we can take them at the end of your slide presentation.
All right. In the statewide support services component, and administrative services, we are asking for a $100,000 increase in unrestricted general funds to cover the increase needed to initiate a new lease in Sedalia for a facility owned by the University of Alaska. This new facility will provide a suitable workplace and has the added recruitment and retention benefits of providing employee bunkhouses for seasonal fish and game staff in the Sedalia area. One of the major difficulties we've had in filling seasonal positions lately has been due to housing issues. And we are terminating an unsuitable lease for our current building in Sedalia. The building has slope flooring, plumbing and electrical issues, exposed insulation, and a roof leak. This impacts both seasonal and permanent staff in that location. Fish and Game's unique safety concerns and protocols are inherent to the work of the department. Some of our employees operate machinery and lab equipment, as well as vessels and aircraft, and work out of field camps with potentially dangerous wildlife and environmental conditions. The department currently provides a wide range of safety training, some with the option to attend online courses if it's appropriate. However, recognizing that our employees face a variety of potential risks to safety and their well-being, the department is requesting a $326,000 unrestricted general fund increase and a $78,000 interagency. And a new position for a program coordinator to manage this program. As Commissioner was saying earlier, we took an employee survey and employees, they stress their concern for safety. Many employees have no field experience and they need training to operate a boat or skiff and to respond to vessel or aircraft emergencies and to address basic first aid needs. The program coordinator position will manage the department's safety program and ensure the use of up-to-date materials, safety technology, and coordinate access and travel to safety classes. This position will help prioritize and identify opportunities to mitigate risks and take safety improvement related actions, including providing a consistent onboarding training process for new employees across all divisions. We are also requesting 3 new IT help desk positions. This would be a 91,000 UGF ask and a 289,000 IA ask. Currently, we only have 4 IT help desk positions, and we have over 1,400 employees. It is not sustainable, and we're having to contract that work out currently. And in boards of fisheries and game, they are requesting a $15,000 increase to of UGF to support their travel needs. In the state subsistence research component, we are requesting a total of $310,000 of CIP receipts. These are for collaborative projects with wildlife conservation, utilizing Pittman Robertson funds. We are also requesting an increase of $205,000 of general funds to address inflation costs. So we threw in the supplemental budget requests. You'll see a lot of these in the base budget increase asks. In commercial fisheries, there's a total increase of $400,000 in statutory designated program receipts, and for reasons that I mentioned earlier. And you'll also see the $35,000 in the pathology laboratory services, the general fund increase ask.
Will you remind me again what we have for in the governor's amended budget for your department? Do you know offhand?
The amended budget, it only consists of these two items for operating.
And then supplemental.
Yeah.
And supplemental, what did you have for last year's supplemental? You know them right off?
Off the top of my head.
Well, I mean, we can get those numbers.
Okay, yeah. Sorry. This is the... state subsistence research component supplemental increase ask, and it's the $210,000 of CIP receipts for the Pittman Robertson.
So we have a very modest supplemental budget request in the operating.
Mm-hmm. Actually, those were it.
Yeah.
So it's just commercial fisheries and state subsistence research. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Representative Josephson.
Through the chair. Commissioner, as to page 24, I see the second a bullet point, although there's a fish there, not a bullet. But anyway, Endangered Species Act, Marine Mammal Protection Act challenges. This reminds me of the Department of Law subcommittee a bit in that I would love to hear about an example where, for example, a challenge was brought. Well, you say challenge. A claim was brought. ESA, for example, and the department said, that's a righteous claim. We're not going to challenge that. I don't know, for example, if it's the Chinook salmon on the Kuskokwim. I would love to hear an example where either an individual or NGO or the federal government said, we're gravely concerned about X. And the state said, we share your concern.
North Pacific right whales.
North Pacific
right whales. We share the concern over North Pacific right whales. There's the population of North Pacific right whales is at such a level that males and females are having a hard time finding each other. We're working now to, we would never question that designation as an endangered species. We never have challenged it. I think we might have a slight disagreement over what critical habitat should be for that species. Is it where they could occupy or what the central area is right now? But we would never question whether or not that species is an endangered species.
Follow
up? Yes.
That is the second very concrete answer, and I'm grateful again. What is the state doing to aid in the effort to restore right whales?
So North Pacific right whales, since they're out basically in the maritime refuge, I mean, out in the North Pacific Ocean, kind of south of the Aleutians, and actually come up sometimes into the Bering Sea. we're trying to work with the North Pacific with the National Marine Fisheries Service to assess how often they're seen in the Bering Sea fishery, and if in fact they're seen, how often those encounters are, so that we can develop a reasonable and prudent management regime that prevents interactions with those, because we certainly don't want to lose any of those at this point in time.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. That concludes our presentation today.
So let me just
I guess it doesn't.
Just real quick. I just want to say that with ESA, there's a species that we agree or disagree with on, but there are also times when we have petitions from third parties like Stuckley bumblebees that are petitioned for listing. And we did not believe in the state of Alaska that we had Stuckley bumblebees. So when we got engaged and we actually looked at the genetic samples that were in the lab in the university and various other places, we found out that our bees that they thought were Stuckleys were Western. So we were able to not have that species listed in the state of Alaska and not have critical habitat for a species that didn't really exist because it was misidentified. So those are the things that we do a lot of research on. Are these species actually present? You know, what are the risks associated with them prior to just in helping the agency make those determinations? And I think we're getting to that point now with Chinook salmon. We have a listing for Chinook salmon by the Wild Fish Conservancy. And, you know, they're basing a lot of their risk assessment on the fact that we're not meeting escapement goals. Well, escapement goals are built around maximum sustained yield. That's a lot different than viability goals. And so we're trying to work with National Marine Fisheries Service to say, are there viability issues or are there yield issues? And Endangered Species Act is around viability, not around yield. So we're trying to help them understand that process as we move forward to it. So that money that we have in Endangered Species Act is to make those kinds of biological assessments so that we can work with the agency to hopefully have them make a reasoned and prudent decision.
Very good. All right. Our next meeting is Tuesday, February 27th at 1:30 p.m. Committee will be receiving an overview of the proposed FY25 budget from the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs and the Department of Administration. Ooh. And with no further business before the committee, we are adjourned. Thanks.
I just